Basically, what we're trying to answer is, why do people think that life is so hard for them?
We wanted to try to get a handle on how or why it's so easy for people to feel put upon, to feel resentful, to feel that life has made things harder for them than it has for other people.
That's Tom Gilovich.
I'm a professor of psychology at Cornell University, and I study how people make judgments and decisions in their everyday and professional lives.
And Shai Davidai.
Or in Hebrew, Shai Davidai. And I'm an assistant professor of psychology at the New School for Social Research.
Gilovich and Davidai recently published a paper called The Headwinds, Tailwinds, Asymmetry. In addition to being a clever piece of experimental research, it has the amazing capacity to make you feel both much better about your life and much worse.
Yeah, in a nutshell, that is the paper.
It explains why you think your parents were tougher on you than your siblings.
So my older sister, she had all the freedom because she was older. She got to go out and do things, but I got punished.
It explains why rooting for your sports team can be so painful.
There is a tendency to feel like the team that you favor has a harder time than other teams.
It explains why Democrats are convinced the deck is stacked against them and why Republicans are convinced of the same thing.
They really are.
And most important, it explains why most of us aren't nearly as grateful as we ought to be.
How did I get even to be alive? How did I get to be alive in a world that has the beauty that it does and so on?
Today on Freakonomics Radio, how we build resentments, how those resentments can curdle our well-being, and how we would all benefit from feeling some more gratitude. Okay, I'll try it. Today, I'm grateful for that song. You know, the song that goes like this.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So, what are you grateful for today?
I'm grateful for Tom.
Shai Davidai again.
I'm not joking. I know I had the best graduate school advisor, mentor, and friend in Tom. And the fact that we could sit there for hours and just talk about our ideas and then go and see if those ideas are real, run experiments, and then, you know, and then talk about a result. That was just an amazing experience.
For what it's worth, the feeling is mutual.
Shai's just terrific, and I'm convinced he's going to have a great career.
Davidai, 33 years old, got his PhD in psychology just a couple years ago. If you were going to pick a mentor in the field, you couldn't do much better than Tom Gilovich.
You're too kind.
Many of the topics we've discussed on this program over the years, especially those relating to behavioral economics, owe a debt to Gilovich's research. I'd love to read off just a quick list of phenomena that you're known for studying, in some cases pioneering, and maybe have you just give a very brief description of what the thing is and what it means. So, okay. Number one, the spotlight effect.
Yeah, the spotlight effect refers to a feeling most of us can relate to. It's the feeling that when we're doing something that other people are really attending to what we're doing, that the social spotlight is on us. And it turns out that other people are paying much less attention to us than we think.
Right. The hot hand notion, or maybe the hot hand fallacy.
Well, everyone who's ever played the game of basketball just knows you get this feeling where the game seems to slow down. It becomes easier. You almost don't even have to aim that carefully. The ball's just going to go in. It's one of the most compelling feelings that you can have. And it turns out if you statistically analyze people's shots, whether it's professional games, college basketball players shooting in a gym. Although the feeling exists, when you make several shots in a row, you will feel hot. That feeling, very surprisingly, doesn't predict how you're going to do in the next shot or the next several shots. The distribution of hits and misses in the game of basketball looks just like the distribution of heads and tails when you're flipping a coin, although, of course, not every player shoots exactly 50%. Very few of them do.
Talk for just a minute about your work in happiness or hedonic studies.
Yeah, almost so many psychologists who study judgment decision-making have an interest in well-being or happiness as well, because after all, we try to make sound judgments and decisions to advance our physical and psychological well-being. So the question just asks itself, how good a job do we do of that, and how can we advance our well-being more? And in my particular case, that has involved studying such emotions as regret, decisions gone awry, gratitude, either on the part of decisions that have worked out well or just events that have happened to a person that you feel grateful for.
Great. Briefly describe your research into bias blind spot.
Yeah, the bias blind spot is refers to the fact that everybody knows that people are biased, but it's much easier to see the bias in other people than in oneself.
And one last one, and this one, it strikes me, plays into today's conversation about headwinds and tailwinds, self-handicapping. Describe that for me briefly.
Yeah, self-handicapping is a familiar idea, particularly if we go back to the world of sports, where before a contest, people claim a certain obstacle in their favorite team's path that, maybe we'll win, but we've got a key player out. And that's setting everyone up for an explanation if you should lose. Students often do this too. They might study as hard as they can and pretend that they haven't studied. So if they bomb the exam, people don't think they're challenged. And if they should succeed, all the better. It's a more glorious victory if you've overcome an obstacle. So people will put these obstacles in their path to manage other people's and their own attributions or explanations for why they succeeded or failed.
Why people succeed and fail. An important topic, plainly, but a complicated one, especially for academic psychologists like Gilovich and David I. It's a huge question, a messy question with a ton of variables, hard to measure. But people's attributions or explanations for why they succeeded or failed, that they could explore.
We wanted to try to get a handle on how or why it's so easy for people to feel put upon, to feel resentful, to feel that life has made things harder for them than it has for other people. And at the same time, try to understand why it might be hard for people to be as grateful as perhaps we should.
Which gets us to their paper, The Headwinds, Tailwinds, Asymmetry.
The idea should be familiar to anyone who cycles or runs for exercise. Sometimes you're running or cycling into the wind, and it's not pleasant. You're aware of it the whole time. It's retarding your progress, and you can't wait until the course changes so that you get the wind at your back. And when that happens, you're grateful for about a minute. And very quickly, you no longer notice the wind at your back that's helping push you along. And what's true when it comes to running or cycling is true of life generally.
You argue that gratitude has been shown to be good for us. What's the evidence for that?
A lot of people have done work on gratitude over the last 20 years where they'll do things like have people keep a gratitude diary where every day or every week you write down what you have to be grateful for.
Most people do it at the evening just before they go to sleep, and you do that for a few days in a row, and you just see that people are happier. We're more satisfied with our lives.
Or you have assignments to write a letter to a person every week expressing gratitude for something they've done for you.
And giving it to someone face-to-face, so not just emailing them, but actually sitting there, having them read it, and then having a conversation about it.
And when people do that, they sleep better, they go to the doctor less often.
They also show less depressive symptoms.
So there are all sorts of direct benefits to the grateful person.
It's just amazing how many positive correlates there are to gratitude.
But when you ask people what they're grateful for...
When you ask people, what are you grateful for? The prototypical answer is my parents, my family, my friends, my loved ones. What they're missing is all these invisibles.
What are these invisibles?
Oh, there's so many.
The fact that I had opportunities for education.
How did I get even to be alive?
The fact that we can sit here and talk, right? No one is monitoring what we're talking about. That is something that not everyone has. That is something that we should feel grateful for.
We live in a time of unprecedented wealth and health. New technologies make things easier, cheaper, more convenient. And yet, we quickly learn to complain about the limitations of these technologies. The dropped cell phone calls, the slow internet connections, the slow internet connections while on an airplane.
Psychologists refer to this as the hedonic treadmill. You run really hard to get something. The thing that you get, that you're aiming for, feels good when you've got it. But then you adapt to it and you have to run ever faster to get more and more.
But here's a question. If gratitude is such a positive emotion...
It's just amazing how many positive correlates there are to gratitude.
Then you'd think we'd all be chasing after it hard all the time. So why aren't we? Gilovich and David, I suspect, it has to do with what psychologists call the availability bias, meaning we tend to overweight the experiences that are readily available in our memories, which, Gilovich and David, I argue, are more likely to be headwinds than tailwinds.
We have to pay attention to the barriers in front of us because we have to get over them or get through them in some way. We have to overcome them. We don't have to pay attention to those things that are boosting us along. We can just be boosted along. And that fundamental asymmetry in attention is the headwinds, tailwinds asymmetry.
Meaning that it's easier to summon emotions that are the opposite of gratitude. In fact, they're the enemies of gratitude.
And one of them is habituation or adaptation, that we think if some good fortune befell us, we'd be happy, we'd be grateful, we'd be happy forever, we wouldn't sweat the small stuff anymore. And that's true for a while, but then we adapt to it, and all of a sudden we're sweating the small stuff again.
But that's hardly the only enemy of gratitude.
The big ones are greed and envy.
Okay, first, greed.
Inherent in greed is the idea that this is not enough. It's not a means to an end. Having is the end when you experience greed. And when you're just focusing on this accumulation, it's hard for you to take stock of what you already have.
And envy.
Which is when all you're focused on is whatever people have, especially when it's malicious envy, not benign envy. When you're really focusing on, you know, I don't want them to have that. They didn't deserve this. It's unfair. When you experience that, it's hard to stop and feel grateful.
So that's a theory, at least. Once Tom Gilovich and Shai Davidi identified it, all they had to do was find evidence that it's actually true.
You know, if this headwinds, tailwinds asymmetry is a real psychological phenomena, we should find it in very different contexts and domains.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, evidence of headwinds in family matters, sports, and politics, and how feeling the headwinds might persuade you that your country is in worse shape than it is, and that you need a new leader who will really shake things up.
A willingness to do that, I think, is failing to appreciate all the things that make our lives really the envy of the rest of the world.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
The academic psychologists, Tom Gilovich and Shai Davidi, wanted to know whether people put more emphasis on the headwinds they face, the barriers and obstacles and difficulties, than their tailwinds, like a free society and good health and so on. This meant trying to measure people's perception of headwinds and tailwinds in a variety of domains.
So we did studies to see how it affects siblings' views of whether they had it harder than their brother or sister or easier, whether Republicans and Democrats think that this strange thing known as the Electoral College favors their side or hurts their side, whether sports fans think that the schedule is fair. And then my favorite example comes from my own field of academia in psychology. If you talk to graduate students in different subdisciplines, each subdiscipline will think the other ones have it easier than they do. Developmental psychologists will say, oh, man, I wish I was a social psychology person. I wouldn't so much easier to run college students than it is to run a baby. But then you talk to the social psychologists, like, oh, the developmentalists have it so easy. They have sample sizes of like 6 to 8. We now have to run 100 in each condition. And every group bemoans its own difficult fate.
Okay, we'll start with the sibling study.
The one thing that we kept coming back to is this idea that siblings always feel like the other one had it easier.
For this study, David I. Angilovich recruited people who had only one sibling, no twins allowed.
And we asked them to think back to when they were younger, both living at the same house. Think about how their parents treated them versus their brother or sister. Who got more praise? Who got more encouraged to do things? Who had more freedom to go out and party? And in contrast, who got punished more? Who got lectured more? And what we found was that siblings thought the other one had it easier and that they had it harder.
In other words, headwinds for everybody. Another study looked at how self-identified Democrats and Republicans think their party makes out in terms of raising campaign money and getting Congress to cooperate and winning the Electoral College. As with the siblings, people on either side of the political aisle felt the other side had all the advantages. Would the same effect hold true among sports fans?
So what we did is we went on Reddit, on the NFL subsection of Reddit, right after the 2014 schedule was published. And we just wanted to see how people are reacting.
Specifically, they wanted to see how fans perceived their team's upcoming schedule.
Do I tend to think that my team had it easier or harder? The headwinds, tailwinds asymmetry predicts that what would jump off the page of the schedule when you look at it are all the hard games your team has to play.
And what we found was that most of the comments were about how difficult it is for me.
Finally, Gilovich and David I. looked at some of their academic brethren to see if they, too, primarily feel the headwinds. They looked at accounting professors.
They can, like in many disciplines, be divided into experimental and non-experimental accountants.
What's an experimental accountant?
What they do is study the human aspect and the human behavior of accounting. So things like auditing, things like when do people lie and when can we detect lying, stuff like that.
Gilovich and David I. surveyed roughly 100 experimental and non-experimental accountants.
And we asked each of them, how easy is it for experimental and non-experimental accountants to get their papers published, to get grants, to get tenure, and so on? And each of them thought that it was easier for the other group than it was for them to have these good things happen. But to this study, we added a twist. After having them get themselves in touch with their headwinds more than their tailwinds, we then asked them about a variety of what you might call questionable research practices. Is it okay to take money from a questionable source if the research itself is okay?
Is it okay to publish the same paper twice in two very different journals?
Can you put your name on a paper as a co-author if you really didn't do anything?
What we wanted to see is, does seeing your field and yourself as disadvantaged, does that give you more moral flexibility? Does that allow you in your own mind to maybe cut some corners?
And what you find is that if people have just thought about who has it harder or easier, them or other people in their discipline, they are more accepting of these questionable research practices. So when you feel like, no, the deck is stacked against me, it appears that people want to make up for that, and they're willing to kind of bend the rules to do that.
And obviously that has a lot of implications for real life.
It encourages feeling resentful and unappreciative. And that's a psychological state where we're not at our best.
I'm curious how the idea of headwinds and tailwinds plays into the conversation these days about privilege versus discrimination or lack of opportunity. So there's a lot of conversation about white and or male privilege. Perhaps that's an example of tailwinds that aren't properly appreciated. And on the other side, some claims of discrimination or lack of opportunity, perhaps being an example of headwinds being exaggerated. I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I think what we've shown in the lab is directly applicable to some of the discussions going on in the country right now. There's this term that that there's a war on white males these days, white Christian men, and channeled through the headwinds, tailwinds, asymmetry, you could see why that group would think that. That is to say, the influence they've had has decreased, and of course, that's the focus of their attention, that decrease. At the same time, if you look at it from the outside, what you see is an enormous advantage that had existed for hundreds of years being reduced just a little bit. And from an outside perspective, it doesn't look like at all like a war. It looks like, yeah, just a little bit of rebalancing, and we even need to rebalance some more.
What about on the flip side? What about if I feel aggrieved, if I feel I am facing way more headwinds than the other people around me, whether it's in the labor markets or in academia or whatever, do you see that misperception being a significant barrier to progress for me, again, individually or societally?
I do, because it feeds resentment, which doesn't make us our best selves, that prevents us from thinking most rationally and acting most productively. Each community is going to think that the other one has it easier than they do, when in fact they don't. That's the misperception. And if they think that the other group has it easier, that's tempting. First of all, it's going to make them less likely to want to do good things for people in the other community. And it might even encourage them to do some questionable things to, in their minds, even though the slate is already even. It's that misperception that we're particularly interested in.
All right, let me ask you a related question. What do you know, or what does the field know, about the characteristics of people who don't overweight headwinds?
Ah, that's a great question. That's something that Shai and I are working on right now. And it's not that we're never aware of our tailwinds, and they just don't come up, or we are less aware of them than our headwinds. And so we've asked people, we explain the headwinds, tailwinds asymmetry, and we ask them, what are some of the headwinds you've suffered from and the tailwinds you've benefited from? And we get some noticeable differences. That is, the headwinds are quite a mix of animate things, other people who are getting in my way, and inanimate things, bureaucracies, procedures, structural things. But when you look at the tailwinds people are aware of, they tend to cite way disproportionately the intervention of other people. When other people do things for us, it's a charming result in a way, that registers, and we're grateful. If you tell people how lucky they are, they don't like that. they guard against it. They're like, wait, what are you? You're diminishing my achievements. But if you ask people, how has luck played a role in your life, people can get in touch with their tailwinds or how lucky they are. So it really suggests an ask, don't tell policy when it comes to either luck or a particular type of tailwind or all the other tailwinds.
So, Tom, let me ask you this. Let's say I've heard you discussing this, and I find you an incredibly, you know, even-handed and credible assessor of these phenomena, and that I believe you, I believe your research. What can I do to appreciate, then, the reality of my tailwinds and to not overweight, not get resentful, and therefore counterproductive as a result of my headwinds?
Right. Scientists are, you know, fond of saying, and I do believe it, that, you know, knowledge sets you free. Just knowing about this will be helpful. So I want to put that out first and foremost. But the more specific version of the knowledge tends to be most helpful. You've had guests on before that have talked about the confirmation bias, one of the most powerful sources of distortion in our judgments. When we're testing, we're trying to evaluate something, we look for evidence that it's true. Because after all, if it were true, there should be evidence for it. So we look for it. A very, very sensible thing to do. But we also have to look for evidence against. And so the general recommendation there is, all right, don't fall prey to the confirmation bias. Try to consider the opposite is the way that psychologists put it. That's the evidence for this. What's the evidence against it? And that's good advice. But it's a little general. It would be nice to make it more concrete. And so psychologists have developed some more concrete recommendations. One is to, and I really like this one, is to do what's called a pre-mortem. That is to say, if you believe that a certain policy is the right one, you tend to over-recruit evidence in favor of that belief. You try the policy. Rather than telling people, consider the opposite, you say, okay, imagine that you tried the policy and after a year it crashed and burned and you'd be doing a postmortem, figure out what went wrong. Do that in advance. Do that right now. Imagine it worked out badly and then explain it to yourself. That is a more specific recommendation that I think people can really sink their teeth into. Or have a devil's advocate to argue against you. That's specific. That's doable. And so it's more helpful. And so with respect to the headwinds, tailwinds asymmetry, I think of it in part as a slightly more specific version of what the gratitude researchers have been asking people to do, which is write down or think about all that you have to be grateful for. That's good advice, but it can be hard to do, or at least hard to do consistently. If you start to run out of gas in doing that, ask yourself a slightly different question, which is, what are my tailwinds? Not what do I have to be grateful for, but what are the ways in which I'm boosted along the invisible things that make my life easier? Let me focus on those, and different things might come up.
As it is written, may the road rise up to meet you, may the wind always be at your back. To which I guess we should add, and may you appreciate the wind when it's at your back, and when it's not, deal with it a little less resentfully. Thanks to Tom Gilovich of Cornell and Shai Davidi of the New School for Social Research for teaching us about the headwinds-tailwinds asymmetry today. Coming up next on Freakonomics Radio, Chuck E. Cheese's is famous as a gathering place for families with kids. It's also infamous as a place where fights break out.
No! Chuck E. Cheese action!
What's going on when a fight breaks out at a family restaurant? Is it a pizza problem? An alcohol problem? Or, here's another theory, a pricing problem. That's coming up next on Freakonomics Radio. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts, or at Freakonomics.com, where you can also find our books, the blog, and much more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Hey, Levitt, you ever go to a Chuck E. Cheese with your kids or maybe on your own?
Well, you can't go on your own. They won't let you in if you don't have kids.
Is that true?
It is true. I'm happy to say I didn't find that out the hard way. I didn't actually show up at a Chuck E. Cheese without my kids. But I have heard that they will not let you in without children.
So you've been with children?
I have. It's been a long time. But in the day, I used to take my kids there. And you know me, I like the simple things in life. And that means I love places like Chuck E. Cheese. I just love arcade games. They are fun. They're a great mix of manual dexterity and a little bit of thinking.
And have you ever become violent at a Chuck E. Cheese because someone else's kid wouldn't, you know, get off the skee ball?
Yeah, I can proudly say I have never become violent at Chuck E. Cheese, never even been tempted towards violence at Chuck E. Cheese.
That's Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. Chuck E. Cheese, if you are not familiar with it, is a popular family entertainment spot with pizza and arcade games.
Chuck E. Cheese's, where a kid can be a kid.
I was asking Levitt about the potential for violence at Chuck E. Cheese, which officially is Chuck E. Cheese's possessive, but most people shorten it to Chuck E. Cheese or Chuck E. Cheese, because that's what a Freakonomics Radio listener had asked us about.
I'm not the type of guy to hit somebody, and certainly not a child, but it led me to kind of think it did seem plausible.
Today on Freakonomics Radio, we ask a simple question. How does the price of a good or a service affect consumer behavior? Our cast of characters include our economist.
Okay, so the one thing I want to get across is the idea about rivalry.
Our listener.
Do I personally feel okay with that? No.
We hear from the founder of Chuck E. Cheese.
It's an interesting theory.
The current administration of Chuck E. Cheese.
The first thing I'll say is incidents at Chuck E. Cheese's are very rare.
We hear what happens when things go wrong at Chuck E. Cheese. We ask, what's price got to do with it?
I think it certainly could be.
And we hear Steve Levitt's brilliant idea for testing this theory.
Maybe I could dress up as a child, you could be the adult, and then we could see how many other parents, if I monopolize a game, end up attempting to beat you into a pulp.
So, Levitt, I've often heard you say that the one thing that economists are reliably fairly good at doing is setting the appropriate price of a good or service. Can you explain briefly, in your economist speak, how you do that?
So essentially, the art of setting prices is simply figuring out what price to set so that you have the marginal cost of providing that good equal to the marginal revenue generated by the sale of that good.
So the danger of setting a price too high if you're selling would seem to be obvious, right? People don't buy what you're selling. But what's the danger of setting a price too low?
The danger of setting a price too low, of course, is that too many people want to consume the good. If it's a kind of good where someone takes it and walks out of the store, then you'll find that the shelves are empty. In the case where it's not something we actually take out of the store, but instead something you experience, then what you end up having are long lines of people, all of whom want access to that same good, but only a few of whom can actually consume the good.
We've talked a lot on this program about how price affects behavior. For instance, one of the most effective tools to cut smoking, price and tax hikes.
What we know is that if you increase the price by 10%, you will decrease total cigarette consumption by 3 to 4%.
But what about when prices fall? The price of food has generally fallen over the past few decades, which makes it easier for people to eat too much. When the price of gasoline drops, people tend to drive more, which leads to more congestion, pollution, and crashes. If you own a bar and you suddenly drop the price of all beverages from $5 to 5 cents, how do you think that's going to work out? So the relationship between price and behavior, especially bad behavior, can be pretty strong. And that's what led one Freakonomics Radio listener to put two and two together and come up with a theory.
My name is Nathan Corey, and I'm a financial advisor in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Corey used to go to Chuck E. Cheese when he was a kid. His experiences were always very positive.
Oh, yeah, very positive. Yeah, absolutely.
Now he's got kids of his own.
I've got two sons. One is about 3.5, and the other is 4 months.
So he thought about taking his older son to Chuck E. Cheese, but he was also a little wary because of something he'd seen on the news.
Certainly in the Milwaukee area for the past few years, there's been reports of violence always coming up in the news at Chuck E. Cheese locations.
Violence at a restaurant chain that caters to little kids and their families? Yes, indeed. If you just Google Chuck E. Cheese and fight, you'll find plenty of videos like this one.
Out up in Chuck E. Cheese.
And like this one.
Stop.
Now, we should point out, it's the adults fighting, not the kids. We should also point out that the adults may have been drinking, because most Chuck E. Cheese's serve wine and beer.
Yeah, it strikes me as pretty odd. Now, granted, we're in Wisconsin where we, you know, would drink beer at church if we could.
Anyway, when Nathan Corey decided to bring his young son to Chuck E. Cheese for the first time, he wanted to minimize the chance that he would encounter any violence.
We went right when it opened in the morning, so we were literally the only people in the whole place.
They had a good time playing the arcade games.
And what I noticed right away after playing a couple of games with my son was that every machine in Chuck E. Cheese costs just one token.
even the games that lasted the longest, that seemed like they should have been more expensive.
And that really struck me as being kind of odd that there was no price variance between the games.
You know, this was a subject of debate.
That's Nolan Bushnell, who founded Chuck E. Cheese 40 years ago in San Jose, California. The debate was whether to make some games more expensive than others.
We felt that since most of our revenue really came from kids under eight, I felt that it would be confusing. And we tested a few things, and we found that it really didn't change the revenue that much. What you're assuming is that we'd make more money if we charged more. It turns out that that isn't the factor.
Before Chuck E. Cheese, Bushnell co-founded the video game company Atari. Chuck E. Cheese was a way to maximize his profits from popular games like Pong.
Well, in the case of Pong, it was such a hit that you'd sell it for $1,000, and in its lifetime, it'd make $30,000. It didn't take rocket science to say, hey, I'm on the wrong side of this equation. I shouldn't just be selling the machines. I should be operating the machines.
So we were basically a Silicon Valley startup, and we're going to be celebrating our 40th anniversary in May of 2017.
That's Michael Hartman.
And I'm the chief marketing officer at CEC Entertainment.
CEC Entertainment being the parent company of Chuck E. Cheese. Today, CEC is owned by a private equity firm. And was Chuck E. Cheese one of the first what are now known as family entertainment concept companies where, you know, kids and parents come together to do stuff, have fun, play games, and eat?
Absolutely. We were definitely one of the first family entertainment concepts. If you look back, you know, in terms of what the competition and the landscape was in 1977, it was bowling alleys, dingy arcades, and movie theaters. And what Nolan wanted to do was to make video games more accessible to families and to younger children.
Part of that accessibility is affordability.
Our guest is very price conscious, and so we want to make sure that they can have an excellent experience for a family of four starting at about $30.
Which means keeping the price of games low. The price varies a bit depending on what kind of package you buy, but rule of thumb, each token costs only about 20 cents, which, believe it or not, is what it cost to buy one Chuck E. Cheese token 30 or 40 years ago. So if you're ever looking for a part of the modern world that is somehow untouched by inflation, there you go, Chuck E. Cheese game tokens. And as Nathan Corey saw when he took his young son there,
every machine in Chuck E. Cheese costs just one token.
Now, that's not quite accurate, and as we'll hear later, change is afoot. But here's what happened the next time Corey took his son to Chuck E. Cheese.
This was a Saturday. So as we were there, it started to get more and more crowded, and we didn't kind of have that free reign of being able to go and play any game we wanted without waiting. And I was in line with my son. We were going to play one of the smaller basketball hoop shooting games. And there were two kids in front of us that were playing that game, and they were just feeding tokens and, you know, not giving up their turn. And so as I'm seeing them feed tokens in the machine, I'm thinking, wow, it's costing nothing to do that. And that was kind of the aha moment of this is the problem with the pricing model, and this could be one of the unintended consequences.
The unintended consequences that Corey was thinking about were the fights he'd heard about on the news.
Chuck E. Cheese chain markets itself as being a fun and safe place for your children.
Chuck E. Cheese seems to have a history of violence nationwide. Earlier this year in Connecticut, a dozen adults were caught on camera throwing punches.
Nathan Corey wondered if the fights he'd heard about were perhaps the unintended consequence of Chuck E. Cheese's pricing structure. The games were so cheap to play that you could just camp out for hours at your favorite game and choke off access to everybody else, which could lead to trouble.
Well, I'm not the type of guy to hit somebody, and certainly not a child. But it did seem plausible that somebody might start talking to the kids, and the kids maybe go get their parents, and an altercation would start that way. Or certainly if it was among just adults. You know, if you were there later on a Saturday and everybody's drinking beer and you're trying to play the basketball game and there's, you know, a line of adults waiting.
I asked Steve Levitt if he could imagine that the Chuck E. Cheese pricing scenario encouraged violence.
Well, I absolutely could imagine it because when it comes to Chuck E. Cheese and the product they deliver, they suffer from a very intense form of what economists call rivalry, meaning that exactly one person can play a particular game at a time. And when people all want the same thing, there are lots of different dimensions on which they can compete for that thing. And certainly physical violence is one we see. I mean, I've studied drug dealing a lot. And indeed, when it comes to the pursuit of property rights in drug markets, violence is the strategy of choice. Now, I have to say I'm a little bit skeptical in thinking that when it comes to queues at the Chuck E. Cheese, that violence is usually the likely weapon to which rival parents might turn.
So you're saying that Chuck E. Cheese customers are probably not as prone to resort to violence as crack dealers?
Well, I think if the stakes were as high, they probably would resort to violence in the same way that the crack dealers do. But when you have something inherently low stakes, like whether your kid can play game A or game B at Chuck E. Cheese, I would think that most parents, even most inebriated parents, wouldn't come to blows.
There certainly is evidence of the violence at Chuck E. Cheese, and I was actually aware of that before we ever went with my son.
That's our listener again, Nathan Corey, who came to us with the price violence theory. Now, given what we know about priming and how the human mind works, you might suspect that if a guy like Corey took his son to a Chuck E. Cheese thinking about the potential for violence, he might have been more inclined to look for a causal explanation for the violence he'd heard about. There are three Chuck E. Cheese's in the Milwaukee area. About a decade ago, after pressure from city officials, they all stopped serving alcohol to cut down on violence. Even so, the disturbances continued, which led Corey to think that maybe the pricing strategy, even more than the alcohol, was the culprit. Sometimes violence can really get out of hand, which can turn into a media story, or a cell phone video of a fight at Chuck E. Cheese can go viral. So, if you pay attention to these reports of violence at Chuck E. Cheese, as Nathan Corey did, you might get the impression that violence at Chuck E. Cheese is a common thing. But is it really?
The first thing I'll say is incidents at Chuck E. Cheese's are very rare.
Michael Hartman again, the chief marketing officer for CEC Entertainment.
You know, we believe that it makes for a greater soundbite to talk about an incident at Chuck E. Cheese's versus anywhere else just because of what our name connotes to folks. But if you think about ball fields and anywhere else where parents and kids are, you'll hear a lot of talk about those kinds of things as opposed to anywhere else.
That makes sense, doesn't it? A fight at a family entertainment place is just incongruous enough that when it does happen, it's more likely to show up on the news or in your Facebook feed than a fight in a ballpark or in a bar. On the other hand, Nathan Corey's theory that Chuck E. Cheese's pricing strategy could be a contributing factor to the fights that do happen? Well, even Chuck E. Cheese founder Nolan Bushnell wouldn't rule it out.
It's an interesting theory. I think it's something that should be tested because it is, in fact, the hogging of a game causal. I mean, many of the games are 2 minutes. And so if somebody's got 10 tokens, it's 25 minutes. That's probably too long, and that could be a problem. But I didn't necessarily get that as the causal nature of their fights.
Okay, so how should the theory be tested?
You could try to run some experiments.
Steve Levitt again.
You know, you and I, Dubner, could go down and figure out what the most popular games are, and maybe I could dress up as a child, you could be the adult, and then we could see how many other parents, if I monopolize a game, end up attempting to beat you into a pulp.
I appreciate you're making me the one that gets beaten, but on the other hand, I think the likelihood of me being beaten is low enough to enjoy the novelty of seeing you dressed up as a child, whatever that means. So I'm okay with that experiment. In the end, we opted for something a little less dramatic. Here's our producer, Christopher Wirth.
If Nathan Corey's theory is true, that prices may contribute to some of the violence at Chuck E. Cheese, then theoretically, we should see less violence at similar entertainment chains that do charge more for more advanced games. For example, Corey suggested Dave & Buster's, a chain that is more oriented for adults than kids, but does serve food and beer and wine, and it has a big arcade area where the games do not all cost the same.
Each of the games has a different price that it costs to play. So it, from what I could tell anyway, seems to kind of control the demand for the games, because you're not going to just keep playing the best games over and over again, because you'd go broke.
I went to Dave & Buster's just to check it out.
They've got Jurassic Park, they've got Kung Fu Panda, they've got Ghostbusters.
Instead of tokens, customers purchase electronic payment cards. Those are then loaded up with chips that are used to play games. Nolan Bushnell, the founder of Chuck E. Cheese, has paid close attention to this industry. And he says Dave & Buster's payment cards allow the company to observe player behavior and make small, incremental changes to game prices. Some games cost 2.6 chips, for example, or about 50 cents. Some games cost 13.6 chips, close to $3.
Dave & Buster's, they implement variable pricing extremely scientifically. I have a lot of respect for their analytical ability.
What we decided to do is collect police data on the number of violent incidents at Chuck E. Cheese and then compare them with Dave & Buster's. And we should say from the start, the method we're using here is highly imperfect. For one, we're not controlling for neighborhood characteristics or anything else. This is just raw data, and spotty data at that. We focused on three large metropolitan areas, Chicago, Phoenix, and Dallas-Fort Worth.
Oh, hi. Trying to reach a media relations person for the police department in Grapevine.
Question for you regarding a records request for the Phoenix Police Department.
We'd like to obtain a list of calls for service to a specific business address, the Chuck E. Cheese.
Let's start with the Chicago area. There, we looked at the 13 Chuck E. Cheeses and four Dave & Buster's located within the broad boundary that we drew around the city. We asked for 5 years' worth of data on what are known as calls for service, which are these long lists that catalog each time a call came in, whether it's for a fight or a false burglar alarm. We tallied up all the assaults, disturbances, battery charges, etc. And what we found is, as a monthly average, there are slightly more violent incidents at Dave & Buster's than at Chuck E. Cheese. The data showed one incident occurred at a Dave & Buster's roughly every 2 months versus one incident every 3 months at a Chuck E. Cheese. And we found similar results in Dallas-Fort Worth. On average, the rate of violent altercations and similar types of incidents was higher at Dave & Buster's. In Phoenix, they were roughly the same. But that doesn't necessarily mean Nathan Corey's theory is wrong. As Nolan Bushnell points out, and as we freely admit, this evidence is far from definitive.
I think that you're almost comparing cheese and chalk.
Not only does Dave & Buster's clientele tend to be older, it stays open later. And while some Chuck E. Cheeses serve beer and wine, Dave & Buster's has a full bar.
The amount of alcohol all by itself changes things tremendously.
We wanted to find a company that's a closer match to Chuck E. Cheese. And that's when we discovered another pizza chain for kids called Peter Piper Pizza.
At Peter Piper Pizza, you don't need a lot of dough to afford a pizza. A large cheese pizza is only $3.50.
Peter Piper Pizza was founded in Phoenix. And like Chuck E. Cheese, tokens there cost just 20 cents each if you have a coupon. But unlike Chuck E. Cheese, it prices its games from 1 to 4 tokens, according to how advanced the games are. Plus, Chuck E. Cheese's parent company, CEC Entertainment, acquired the chain in 2014.
The demographic is almost identical, with the exception that Peter Piper Pizza tends to skew a little bit lower demographically in terms of income.
We collected 10 years' worth of police data. In the Phoenix area, we looked at 11 Peter Piper pizzas and 5 Chuck E. Cheeses. But again, the numbers just did not support Nathan Corey's theory. The rate of violent incidents at Peter Piper Pizza was about 64% higher than it was at Chuck E. Cheese. But then compare that with Dallas-Fort Worth, where we pretty much found the opposite. There, we looked at 16 Chuck E. Cheeses, 4 Peter Piper pizzas, and as a monthly average, the rate of disturbances and violent incidents was 70% higher at Chuck E. Cheese than at Peter Piper Pizza. Although, we should say, we're talking about fairly low rates of violence overall. In the Dallas-Fort Worth area, Chuck E. Cheese averages a little more than one incident every 4 months, and 22% of those were cataloged in the police data as domestic disputes, which is something we heard from a number of the police departments we contacted.
A lot of times when there's large family gatherings at a Chuck E. Cheese, It's for a birthday or a celebration or something.
That is Chief Robert Martin of the Susquehanna Township Police Department in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. The Chuck E. Cheese there had its share of fights, although he says things have quieted down as of late. But what you had are situations where the parents might be divorced, maybe a new boyfriend or girlfriend shows up.
And all of a sudden, some tensions arise that are already present before the celebration within the family dynamic, and it escalates to the point where we were called.
So after filing all those records requests, the data that we have just don't suggest that prices have anything to do with the violence at Chuck E. Cheese. In fact, what they show is that even though the fight videos are shocking and dramatic, the rates of violence at most Chuck E. Cheese's is actually fairly low.
That was Christopher Wirth. Admittedly, the data were spotty, the analysis a little more impressionistic than empirical. That said, there was no compelling evidence for the Chuck E. Cheese theory of customer violence caused by low game prices. A more rigorous way to address the question would be to simply ask Chuck E. Cheese to help us with a big randomized controlled trial. For instance, what if they randomly divided their 500-plus locations, varied the prices in some and left the others low, and then measured how that affects customers' behavior, including fights? That's not going to happen. But as it turns out, there are some related changes already underway at Chuck E. Cheese.
In late 2014, we started testing an RFID card program to see how our guests and our consumers would like moving over the card system.
That's Mahesh Satarangani.
I'm the Senior Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at CEC Entertainment.
Since it began, Chuck E. Cheese has used tokens for gameplay. But, Satarangani says, they've started the conversion to plastic cards.
And that switch over to cards was much smoother than we anticipated. And we're happy to say that as of the end of 2016, we've completed roughly 268 of our stores on the PlayPass card reader system. And we look forward to completing the entire network of our 512 U.S. stores by the end of 2017.
An RFID card allows for a lot of options that old-fashioned metal tokens don't. Chuck E. Cheese will have better data on what its customers like and don't like, and it gives pricing flexibility, too. While most games and activities at Chuck E. Cheese have historically cost just one token, some longer or more involved games cost two tokens.
When you take a game from one token to two tokens, that's a pretty large price increase, 100%. And if you take it to 3 points, it's a 200% price increase, right?
The new card system allows for more incremental increases.
We'll actually start to test these where we can move to a multi-point strategy. And instead of a game being 1 point or a game being 2 points or 3 points, a game can be 1.2 points.
A card system also allows for dynamic pricing, like airlines and hotels do, raising the price during peak demand or offering discounts at other times, all of which could help alleviate the potential for disagreements among Chuck E. Cheese customers, if indeed there are many disagreements among Chuck E. Cheese customers, which, as we heard earlier from Christopher Wirth, doesn't seem as if there are that many. We shared the police data with Steve Levitt, asked him what he made of it, especially the data from Chicago, where he lives. Now, Levitt, you've looked at the data. Does roughly one police call every 3 months to the Chuck E. Cheese universe of Chicago strike you as noteworthy?
No, not really. I think if the police get called to a Chuck E. Cheese once every few months, not that much. And many of the calls are for things like domestic custody disputes and things, which I don't think the parents
are. Hard to blame Chuck E. Cheese for that.
Yeah, the parents aren't fighting over the games. They're fighting over the kids. So I don't know. It doesn't seem that bad to me.
One thing did stand out in the data we sent over to Levitt. It wasn't a Chuck E. Cheese location. It was one Dave & Buster's location that got way more police calls than any other place in the Chicago data. Is that really the one there where you go?
Yeah, that's one I go to all the time.
You go there for the violence, or it's just coincidence?
Maybe I'm part of the violence. So far, I have escaped official statistics. But the Dave & Buster's to which I go with my kids now turns out to be roughly about 4 to 5 times as likely to elicit a police call as a Chuck E. Cheese. And I think that makes sense because it's not inhabited by 5 to 9-year-olds. It's inhabited by a bunch of 15 to 24-year-olds. And as we all know, if you want to get the police involved, 15 to 24-year-olds are the age group you want to interact with.
All I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you cannot wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at Freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe. I'd also like to give a quick shout out to this station and all the public radio stations around the country who play Freakonomics Radio. We realize your airtime is incredibly valuable, and we are delighted you share it with us. So, thanks.